Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Ben Flanagan of AL.com. Ben Stark of Wondermill Films.
Ben Stark, what's up?
Hey, Ben.
Hey, so we both saw the newest Mission Impossible movie, Mission Impossible 6, a.k.a. Mission Impossible Fallout, or I should say Mission:Impossible Fallout. And so here we are. And I, probably like you, and I don't think you let on, I was aware of a lot of the hype going into this movie from critics who had obviously seen it well before we had. I've seen the Rotten Tomatoes score. I heard people calling it the best action movie, or the best of the franchise, one of the best action movies of all time. I'm seeing scores like 98% on Rotten Tomatoes with 240-something reviews. And it's just like, whoa! I was already looking forward to this. I, like you, am a huge fan of the Mission Impossible franchise and consider it on a roll following Rogue Nation, which I thought was outstanding, arguably the best of the franchise. It at least has a case for it. So I didn't need much beyond just being a fan of that going into Fallout. But when I got all that hype, I tried not to let it shape how I felt about the movie. But to be honest with you, Ben, I don't think that it did. I think the movie just whacked me in the head like Henry Cavill whacked somebody with a laptop in a bathroom. And I just it blew me away. And now, all over again, I think we might have a new best in the franchise, but I'm not going to let recency bias get in the way here. I'm going to weigh it a little more as we talk here and beyond. But what did you think? You've seen it twice now.
Yeah, so, I'm trying not to let the recency bias thing get into my head either. I think the best thing I can say is that for the last few weeks, my wife and I have watched all the other Mission Impossible movies. I've seen all of them numerous times. This is very dorky. I've made a Mission Impossible Spotify playlist of like my favorites from all the scores. So I've been ingesting an awful lot of Mission Impossible the last 3-4 weeks or so. And I think the best thing I can say about this movie is that I'm not sick of it. And I went to go see it Friday night with my wife. I went to see it again yesterday. And man, I could watch that movie again right now. Or really any of the movies. And I think that that says an awful lot about the rewatchability, the fun of these movies, and the strength of this movie that, I mean, it's kind of everywhere in terms of people talking about it and still hyping it up. And I'm just right there on that bandwagon with everybody else saying that, yeah, this is indeed maybe the best film in the franchise. And yes, I mean, right now, I might change my mind tomorrow, but when you're talking about great all-time action movies from a stunt action scene perspective, I mean, I think that this is somewhere in the conversation along with The General and Hard Boiled and Supercop and James Bond films and things like that. I think that this is as good as everybody is saying, and for reasons that maybe we can get into. But yeah, I think it's a great movie. It's a special movie, and I'm very happy that it lived up to the hype.
Yeah, I think it might be worth bringing up the James Bond franchise a little bit later. I mean, I don't want to get too into the weeds and comparing the franchises because we love them both. But I think the way that this one, Mission Impossible, continues to grow, I mean, we've got 6 movies now into this franchise. That's a lot. And the fact that all 6 movies are good, really good, in my opinion, and in most people's opinion, that's really unique for an action franchise. And it has, I think, a partial, if not a whole claim to being, if not the, certainly one of the best action movie franchises of all time. And I can't believe, like, we've talked before about other franchises that tend to get better with age. I mean, we've talked before about Fast and the Furious, even falling into that category. I mean, this has, and, you know, maybe not financially, this does well, but certainly not as well as that does globally. But this has left that behind, in my opinion, just in terms of quality of movie, the way the series has progressed, and really how it reflects its star, Tom Cruise, who's the shepherd of this entire franchise. And it's just amazing how good of care all these movies are in the hands of Tom Cruise, who, if you couldn't tell by just the sheer audacity of stunts that he's performing himself in all of these movies, particularly Fallout, just based on the movies themselves. Like, if you're not looking at the individual stunts in a vacuum, if you just look at the whole film, they are so engrossing, entertaining, fun, and just breaths of fresh air. It's just so clear how much this series means to Tom Cruise and really how much the audience means to him. I mean, he literally puts his life on the line to entertain people. And I know that's something that he and writer-director Chris McCrory and anybody involved with the project, that's a line that they keep using to sell people on it. But it's obviously true. And just to we can speak a little more broadly about the franchise in a little bit, but Fallout itself, then, to me, feels like the most complete Mission Impossible movie so far. I think that whenever one of these comes out now, it's going to be like a movie geek holiday, because that just means it's going to urge you to go back and watch all the other Mission Impossible movies. And that list keeps growing, and the marathon keeps getting longer, and all these movies are so great, it becomes a celebration. And so Fallout is now another statistic within the mission, just the glory of the Mission Impossible franchise, and one that I can't wait to revisit when the next one comes out. But for me, I don't know if you feel the same way, just from beginning to end, yes, with all of the spectacle, with all of the amazing stunts and action sequences, from top to bottom, including an amazing finale, this feels like the most complete Mission Impossible movie. I would say the closest thing that comes to it is probably the first one, because the others, you know, as great as they are, I think that each of them has these, like, minuscule shortcomings that prevent me from, you know, putting it right at the top of the list. Like, there are things about it that make me want to put them at the top, but there are also little things that make me keep myself from doing that. Fallout has very few of those things.
Well, I think I've got a theory that about something, and I'm going to get into a few spoilers, so we should bring that up now. That there's going to be spoilers, but I've got a theory that Chris McQuarrie actually engineered this as a bit of a best of movie of the franchise so far, because there are little variations of existing ideas in the series from other movies in the series in this movie. So you've got the idea that a long time agent gets tired of his job and turns rogue, which is the whole Ethan Hunt as John Lark thing, which is a callback to Jim Phelps in the first Mission Impossible. You obviously have the helicopter chase from the first Mission Impossible. You have Max's daughter from the first Mission Impossible. There's obviously the motorcycle chase from the second Mission Impossible. Also the disease outbreak from the second Mission Impossible. The idea that Benji is tracking Ethan as he has to run, and he's basically, his GPS system is Ethan runs very fast. That's from the third Mission Impossible movie. All the BMW chases from the fourth and the fifth one. I don't know. It just seems like I get this feeling that McQuarrie is a huge fan of this franchise and of movies in general. And just when he was coming up with this thing, just sat down and started writing started watching these movies as he was writing to figure out, how can I make what you're saying? How can I make the comprehensive Mission Impossible movie? And I think that the fact that he loves big blockbusters and movies like these, that he studied these movies, and I think the fact that it's a singular voice that's getting all this across, I think that all contributes to that, you know? I mean, the other films were they all started life as, you know, kind of scripts that Tom Cruise ordered and then eventually found a director for, and then, you know, like, all of them are great, but all of them are messy. Like, there's lots of interviews and info on the record about how, all of these scripts were kind of, you know, written as they went in some cases, or at the very least developed over a number of years, like in Mission Impossible 3. But this one was just a guy that Tom Cruise trusted that decided to write and direct one of these movies. And I think that, yeah, I think it's the most comprehensive one. I think it's the best one, probably. And I think that has a lot to do with it.
Yeah, just as entertaining as the films themselves is listening to Christopher McQuarrie talk about them and talk about making them. I mean, I highly, highly recommend listening to any Christopher McQuarrie interview about podcasts.
Yeah, about,
you can find.
About anything. I mean, I've told you this before. He's been like a hero of mine for the last 10 years or so after I heard him on the Jeff Goldsmith podcast talking about Valkyrie. And he just went into such detail about not just the making of the film and the writing of the screenplay, but also his creative process and his personal struggles and, you know, how he kind of had to go wander the wilderness after Wave the Gun and focus on his wife and kids. He's just a very precise thinker, speaker, writer, and director. And I think that's precise is kind of one of those words that I feel like is a really good descriptor for him. You know, there's very little flashy, there's not very much flashy stuff about his directing, his writing, or his personality, but he just kind of just does the work, and it's very clear, and it's always entertaining.
Yeah, he's kind of a filmmaking guru at this point in terms of his transparency and just how much he'll let you into his process. I mean, he doesn't hold anything back. He obviously loves to do it, and he loves to talk about it, and he loves to you know, let people into the process in case they might have questions and they might want to learn from it, or if they just want to be entertained by the amazing Tom Cruise stories he tells
yeah.
when he does that. I mean, it's just, it's unbelievable. In the one thing that I've learned, gleaned from listening to him and just watching these movies, is something you just talked about, sort of like the nature of how these movies are made, especially these last two. It's mind-blowing in terms of them not having a script to when they start making these movies. I mean, they have these, like, set pieces in mind. He talks about he wants locations, you know, from his scouts before he even thinks about writing out scenes. Sometimes he doesn't even have dialogue or scenes until 3 days before they're about to shoot. It, like, the way that they glue these movies together, like, once you watch, like you said, just how precise and tight and entertaining and just cool they are, you sort of scratch your head and wonder, well, how does that methodology make this happen, make the best action movie franchise, or one of the best movie franchises happen the way that they have? You know, a big part of that is obviously Tom Cruise, too, and this collaboration that he and McQuarrie have created with these last two movies. And it's interesting you said that you think McQuarrie is a big fan of the franchise and movies in general. I think it's pretty cool that he looks to Ghost Protocol, a movie that he did some writing work on and played a much larger role than I think a lot of people realize. People probably know it at this point because he's talked about it so much and it's been publicized. But he looks at that movie as a benchmark for the franchise, as sort of like the heart and soul that really gave it life and helped it become what it is today. And certainly, you know, the other movies are great and they have played an enormous role in how people feel about Mission Impossible movies. But I think he's kind of right. The last three movies have a lot in common. And I know that he, you know, is a common denominator and that he's worked on all three of them. But they have, again, they've hit a stride. They feel so vibrant. They have this very distinct personality. And it all revolves around Tom Cruise, again, shepherding these movies, telling these stories, and performing these insane stunts that culminate in such rich and exciting experiences for moviegoers. And regardless, I mean, they're just damn good movies, and you wouldn't guess that, again, they were just kind of like whipped together so quickly the way that he does it, because they feel so complete and they feel so precise.
I mean, honestly, the making of these movies kind of reflect the plots of the movies themselves. You know, these movies seem to be made by a crew of people that don't have everything that they need to get the job done and are constantly on the run. And, you know, the one thing that they can kind of count on is, you know, their personal proficiency and their teamwork. And then, you know, the ridiculous guts of the guy at the center of it all. You know, there's like a complete parallel between the making of a Mission Impossible movie and what happens in a Mission Impossible movie at this point.
Yeah, it seems like the attitude is, we're going to get it done. Like, don't worry about it. We're going to get it done.
Yeah, and we will not let this see the light of day unless it is great.
Yeah, I read an IndieWire ranking of all six of the movies, and they had Fallout as their number one, and the big theme of it, of why they consider it number one, like they said, the genius behind this movie is the theme feels like the movie is basically telling us as moviegoers, I'm not going to let you down. And Tom Cruise seems to have adopted that attitude in making these movies. And, you know, I think it's interesting that Christopher McQuarrie noted in a recent interview that Tom Cruise, at the very same time, was making three movies, Mummy, American Made, and Jack Reacher 2. These three just wholly bland, mediocre to very bad, just middling action movies, all at the same time, in between making these amazing Mission Impossible movies. And I mean, if that's what he has to do to you know, keep the freedom, the autonomy that he has to make these movies, then okay. But you know, at this point in his career, I mean, like, I would be fine if he just made Mission Impossible movies for the rest of it.
Well, I want him to win his Oscar, so like I get, like, he was probably burned by Lions for Lambs, you know, and Valkyrie. You know, those were his attempts to be a serious actor. And I mean, I haven't seen Lions for Lambs, but he does a fantastic job in Valkyrie. I think he's capable of that. But I think he's been kind of burned by those, and he's like, okay, fine. If everybody wants me to be the action star, well, damn it, I'm going to be the best action star on the planet, maybe, that's ever lived.
Nobody comes close right now. Nobody.
And he's pulling it off. Yeah, he's pulling it off. Yeah, like I said, he's in there with, like, Jackie Chan and Buster Keaton as, like, one of the all-time great action heroes. But the, he just seems like he's not that interested in anything but trying to build franchises or trying to kind of make these big flashy movies. And that's a little bit disappointing. You know, I wish he would, yes, I want him to do nothing but Mission Impossible movies as much as possible. But in between them, I would love for him to go back to his 90s approach and early 2000s approach of just, you know, hey, hook back up with Spielberg and make one of these Constitution movies or you know, Michael Mann or somebody like that. And, you know, do something quiet. I want him to win an Oscar if because I think he's capable of it. I think he's a very good actor. And I'll say it, I think he might give one of the best performances of the year so far in this movie. From a emotional standpoint, which is very strong work, and you buy every minute of it, but also from a physical standpoint, I think it's something that it's underrated in terms of what an actor needs to do physically to convey this stuff. And you look at this guy's face during these action scenes and you buy it. You know, you buy that this guy doesn't want to be doing what he's doing. He's not sure he's good at it, but he knows he has to do it. And I think that Tom Cruise uses his body the way that Daniel Day-Lewis uses his voice. You know, and obviously Daniel Day-Lewis also, you know, is a physical actor, but I think it's a mistake to just chalk this up as, oh, it's a guy running around doing stunts. You know, it's not. He's actually conveying a tremendous amount of character and internal life in these action scenes. And the way that McQuarrie shoots up close on him, you can see all that.
Do you think that Ethan Hunt is Tom Cruise's quote-unquote legacy character? Like, is this the character that will define his career as a movie and action star? Obviously an action star, but as
of course,
a movie star.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I don't think there's any, I mean, unless, you know, Top Gun 2 makes $1 billion or something like that, and it makes Maverick, you know, that's it. You know, I think, I mean, we'll wait and see what that Eyes Wide Shut sequel looks like, I guess, too.
Well, and I was going to ask, too, about the Ethan Hunt character. I mean, do you feel like the arc has been consistent? Like, do you feel like it's the same, he's the same character that he was in the first Mission Impossible movie? Or do you think that, yeah, I mean, seriously, like, do you think that
no.
it's sort of...
Well, I think there's
evolved,
an interesting
you,
way
you think
to look at it. Yeah, I mean, I think there's an interesting way to look at it, which is you're probably going to have to do a little bit of reaching to make it totally work. But I think there's an interesting way to look at it as kind of like this coming of age story of in the first movie, he's not the leader. He's kind of a brat in the first movie, you know, and he has to kind of become the leader of a team and clear his name and earn his spot in the agency. In the second one, he's kind of like, it's like his college years. You know, where he's out making out with chicks and being cool. And then in the third one, he settles down. And then, you know, these last few are kind of the grind of adulthood. So I think that, yeah, I think there's some sort of linear line that you could draw of this character, but I don't think it really comes into focus until maybe the fifth movie. You know, I think before that, he's just kind of reacting to what's going on in the plot. And I think in these McQuarrie movies is the first time that it's like, oh, this is a person. And I think that the most interesting thing about Fallout is, not the most interesting, one of the most interesting things is how many times in this movie Ethan Hunt says, I'm sorry. He apologizes to, you know, supporting characters, to the cop that gets shot, to the people in the church when he runs in there. He says it several times to his wife and to Luther. And I mean, I think that's a theme that they've put into this movie, is that this is a guy who he just wants to do the right thing. And when it doesn't go right, he puts it on himself. And he feels like he has to atone for that with a lot of his stunts and things. And there's just not, I mean, if you look at Tom Cruise and Mr. Possible 2, that is just pure bravado and swagger, and he's like trying to be the bad boy. And I'm not saying it doesn't work for that movie. I'm just saying that you look at that character and this character, and clearly he's gone through some stuff, you know? And this is a guy that's been humbled, and there's very little ego here. There's very little swagger here. It's just a guy that feels compelled to do the right thing, and when things don't go right, even if they're not directly his fault, he takes responsibility for it. And I think it's a rare thing. And I think that one of the reasons that the American public, as we are right now, accepts a character like this is because we saw him get to this point. I think if you make a Superman movie or something like that without a background that this character has, people are just going to write it off as, oh, he's a Boy Scout, he's boring, he's one dimensional. It's like, no, this is what the internal life looks like for a good person. You know, our heroes have become so dark and anti-hero that we don't know what to do, you know, when a character like this or Captain America or somebody like that comes along. But I think I could believe that there's an arc here and that he's a true character and not just a name that Tom Cruise puts on when he wants to do some crazy stunts.
Yeah, and J.J. Abrams tried to force that, or not force it, but tried to
Definitely.
Make that work in Mission Impossible 3. And, you know, I think it's interesting you say, you point out how he you know, tells people, he apologizes to people. You know, it's kind of a tragic character in some ways because, I mean, he can never lead a normal life. And like you said, he doesn't necessarily want to do the things he's doing. He just feels, you know, he feels compelled to do the right thing, and he might be the only person fit to do it, right? He's the only person that can get it done. I mean, he's had these arguments with his teammates before that this is the only way, right, to save the world or to get the job done, et cetera. And, you know, he's a guy who follows danger, and once he gets there, more danger follows him. And so that's why he couldn't be married to the Julie Julia character, the Michelle Monaghan character, where they, I think, you know, put a pretty nice bow on her arc in this movie. So yeah, I mean, those are interesting themes, for sure. But, you know, I'm interested in this movie specifically, like, what works, like, why is it the best? Well, like, we talked a little bit about it. You mentioned, like, it's the most comprehensive. I agree with that. But I'm still wrestling with the idea that it's number one in this amazing series of movies that, where I think every movie, and I know people will laugh off Mission Impossible 2, but it's a movie that I really like a lot. So I think every movie in its own way has an argument to be the best of the franchise. So why right now is Fallout leading the pack?
Well, like I said, I think it's the one that's most about something. I think the fourth one is also about, I like the themes of the fourth one an awful lot, just in terms of, like, everything breaks, and everything is going wrong, but, you know, the team works. But I think this one, like I said, that the themes of it, the fact that everything works in service of the story, from the first shot to the last shot, it's all about this guy trying to find redemption. And I think that it's the strongest one in terms of that. I think it's the strongest one in terms of just adherence to the basic plot of the old TV show. I mean, I know that I think it's, you know, I don't think anybody would argue that that Mission Impossible hasn't overtaken its source material, you know. I mean, these movies are a bigger deal than the TV show ever was, and are probably better than the TV show ever was at this point. You maybe couldn't have said that, 10 years ago or something like that. But I think that's the case now. But still, I think that this one does totally adhere to that formula. You know, it starts with him getting a mission, and he doesn't break the IMF. He's not a rogue agent from the IMF. Like, the IMF agents are working together throughout the whole thing. You know, there's not it's not dissolved or anything like that. It's just he's on a mission. It happens to be a mission that is intimately tied to his personal life, which he doesn't realize till the end. But yeah, it follows that structure very nicely. So there's that. I think the action scenes are just exquisite. Like, there's just an extreme clarity. Like I said earlier, like, it's a better version of every other action scene that came in the franchise before it, except for maybe the tower climbing in the fourth one. I think that's about the only action scene that in any of these other movies that isn't topped in this movie. Even the incredible car chase and motorcycle chase in Rogue Nation, maybe that's better than something in here, but I think that the car chase and motorcycle chase, and this is pretty awesome too. I mean, it's got every kind of action scene that you could want. And so it gives you the most variety. It's the most coherent visually, because of the IMAX cameras. It's just, the scale is bigger. It's just the best, man. Like, it checks all the boxes. And again, it makes you feel something more than any of the other ones, I think, other than maybe the third one, you know, that opening scene of Philip Seymour Hoffman and Tom Cruise. That's a pretty incredible emotional scene. But I think this movie, you know, it works on those same levels. So, yeah, I think it just, like I said, just checks all the boxes. The only thing it doesn't have is that tower climbing sequence and a villain as strong as Philip Seymour Hoffman in terms of performance. But I think the villains here are pretty great too.
Yeah, it doesn't have Limp Bizkit either. But you're right. There's not much more you could ask for action wise with this. Like, it has everything. Everything you could want. And what's interesting to hear is Chris McQuarrie in interviews say that they had to cut a lot of it because there was too much action from their perspectives. And, like, my question is, like, how is that possible? When is there ever
right.
too much action? But, you know, they might have a point, because, I mean, I'm trying to think back on, like, what were my favorite set pieces from this movie? And I just think I'm, like, losing count, where I think, yeah, the car chase you're talking about, or the motorcycle chase, or the helicopter chase. And then I think, like, oh, wait, there was that Halo jump, too. Like, I forgot.
Or the running, the running across the rooftops where there's a minute long take of him just sprinting with like the London spinning around behind him. It's incredible.
Amazing. Yeah. And okay. So tell me I'm wrong here, so I'll feel better about myself. Or just help me with a landing spot. The only thing story wise that I'm really kind of wrestling with is the way Ilsa is, I feel kind of inserted into the story. And look, we're both big fans of the addition of Rebecca Ferguson in Rogue Nation. I mean, she's arguably the MVP of that movie. We were both very excited to learn that she would be the first female lead returning to another movie in the franchise, and I was so glad she was back. But if I'm being totally honest with you, my first time watching it, the way she, and she should, because, I mean, she's kind of like a loner in this movie, but the way she sort of skirts the action in this and is sort of on the outside looking in and is a nuisance to the IMF team who are trying to, you know, accomplish their mission, I at times, you know, when Ethan Hunt has to sort of make time to finally meet with her, for whatever reason, like the first time I saw it, it kind of felt like she was a little shoehorned into it. Like McCrory's big challenge with her was trying to figure out how to put her in the movie now that she's back. Did you get that at all?
No. First of all, the scene where they confront each other in that green, like covered tree thing is just beautiful.
Yeah.
Incredibly well shot and preceded by this cool little cat and mouse scene where it's like, oh, you just had this big action set piece, but guess what? We can still make you be interested in just a lady following a man, you know? So I think that's strong. No, I think that if she didn't have a arc, then yeah, I could feel that, but her whole thing is that she's got to kill this guy to kind of earn her stripes back. You know, she
right.
has something to do. And at the end of the day, she doesn't. You know, I mean, we talked about action set pieces. What about that fight with her and Solomon Lane? It was really good. It's, you know, it's number 15 on the top 97 action scenes in this movie.
And if she kills Solomon Lane, like, the IMF team can't let her do that because that will, you know, their mission will fail if hers succeeds.
Right, exactly. So... yeah, I mean, I think that it's complicated and it's in there, but I think that she's got the most interesting journey of any supporting character other than, I mean, he's not a supporting character. I think other than Ethan, she's got the most interesting, story arc. So I think that it's a Mission Impossible movie. So I mean, it's just nobody's going to take the lead other than Ethan Hunt for the time being. So yeah, but I think that it, again, there's a little bit of housekeeping here in terms of, you know, the wife and other things. But I think that part of the housekeeping is getting Ilsa to a point where now she's a fixture and maybe she's part of the IMF now, you know, now that her history with MI6 and with the syndicate is cleared up. I mean, that's a journey that she had to go on. So I thought it was fine. And honestly, I was, the second time I watched it, I was like, okay, I know she's in there at the end of the movie, but like, how does she go from like Ethan Hunt running her over with a car to tagging along with everybody? And as they wove that in with her just kind of shadowing people because she's a spy, it's just organic. Like the way that she kind of becomes a part of the team is so organic that it just works really well for me. And just on a separate note, it kind of speaks to the whole pace of this movie is that the first time I watched it, I had no idea like how far into the movie I was at any given moment. You know, you could have told me I've only been watching it for 5 minutes or 60 minutes, and I wouldn't have been able to guess. And this time, the same thing happened. The second time, it's the same thing happened where it got to the end of the London sequence where he runs and Walker gets away, and he's standing on top of that building. And I was like, how long? Has this movie been on for 15 minutes? Oh, wait, no, the end of the movie is about to start. So I think that's another reason why it rules. It's just the pace is so frenetic that you just can't stop watching. You can't even stop to think about how long you've been watching.
So what's your favorite set piece from this movie? Like you said, there's almost too many to name, but was there one the second time around that stuck out more than the others?
I mean, I want to say the helicopter chase. Yeah, I think it's got to be the first part of the helicopter chase where he's struggling to hang on to the bottom of that helicopter. He falls off on the cargo thing. And he's got that incredible shot where Henry Cavill is in the foreground. And in the background, you just see this poor bastard dangling on a string, you know. It's just, that's the kind of thing where I just love seeing in movies, you know, where it's just a person doing something very difficult, and it's entirely visual, and all the stakes are laid out very nicely. I think that's probably the part of the movie that I just could watch over and over again. But I got to say that entire, basically from the time that they play the kind of the montage of Solomon Lane's helicopter landing to the end of the whole Paris sequence, which is like the second act of the movie, is all just incredible and just doesn't stop. And you think it's over, and then they get into that little BMW, and then you think it's over, and then, you know, the next thing starts, and it's just overwhelming.
Yeah, you know, and I love the Halo jump, and I, like, we barely even mentioned, like, that big bathroom fight with Henry Cavill and Tom Cruise and the other actor in that. It's just, like, such an amazing physical presence in that whole thing. Like, he's just so great. That was awesome, too, but, I'm probably with you. Like, the whole chase in Paris is sick, but then, once you just see, like, the helicopter chase, it's just bug nuts, man. Like, and too, Ethan, like, you forget, like, you're right. Tom Cruise gives a great performance in this movie. Like, there are a couple little moments during the helicopter chase where I just thought, man, Tom Cruise is, like, having fun here, too. Like, acting, like, when he's not even performing a stunt. Like, there are a couple of moments where he's trying to, like, he's overtaking control of his helicopter, and he's trying to sneak up behind Henry Cavill's helicopter. And he tries to drop this payload into the blades of the helicopter below him. And before he does it, he says something like, "Hey guys, hold this for me," you know, before he misses. And then when Henry Cavill sees him and that he's taking over that helicopter, Tom Cruise says, "Yeah, that's right, prick." Like,
prick.
I love
that.
I laughed so hard at that
line. He's just so mad. Like, he's just so mad that this guy ruined his day. Like, that's what I love. And there's, like, just little exclamations in that, you know, in that whole scene where he's just trying to figure out how to fly a helicopter because he doesn't know how. And it's just really entertaining and desperate. And, again, it's that Indiana Jones, John McClane feeling of this guy's in over his head. And it's not fun to watch this guy skate around and be awesome at everything. What's fun is to see this guy scrambling and trying to hold on and survive. And yeah, I mean, any of his things that he does would kill either one of us, but he's like an above average secret agent, but he's still in over his head, and that only, you know, increases the stakes. So yeah, it's what action movie heroics should be.
So Mission Impossible and James Bond, the franchises, they're certainly apples and oranges still at this point. I mean, James Bond is, what, 20-something movies compared to Mission Impossible 6? And Mission Impossible will certainly never have sort of, like, the grand mythology that James Bond does. But at this point, I mean, look, they're both essential spy action movie franchises. And regardless of the volume that one has compared to the other, I at this point would say that the six Mission movies, or however many you want to count, I would stack them up against the six best James Bond movies. Would you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're just, I think they're similar enough to compare. But yeah, I think the consistency here is obviously miles beyond what you get with a James Bond movie, which, you know, for a number of years, James Bond had the excuse of it was just a machine. You know, they're cranking those things out. But when these Mission Impossible movies are as good as they are now, we kind of don't have any excuses for getting anything but great James Bond movies. And yet, you know, we still get these kind of incomplete feeling hodgepodge movies. I like Spectre an awful lot, but I'm not going to tell you that it's the Swiss watch that these things are, you know, even though these had troubled productions, almost all of them. So, yeah, I think that they should be compared, and I think that, yes, you take From Russia with Love or Honor Majesty's Secret Service or Casino Royale, the great James Bond movies, I think that I have no problem putting Rogue Nation and Ghost Protocol and these movies in the same conversation as them.
Yeah, and I would even go as far as to say the Mission Impossible franchise is currently in better shape than James Bond. And you know, that's no knock against James Bond. I agree with you. I like Spectre. I like, you know, pretty much all the Craig movies, but there's a little bit of uncertainty about its future, and that's just the nature of the James Bond franchise. They're different animals in that, you know, the James Bond franchise can go a number of different ways, and it evolves uniquely.
Well, there's also, I mean, James Bond has been tied up in rights issues for the better part of, like, two decades in terms of, like, you know, they just don't know what they want to do. And when they know what they want to do, there's, you know, Kevin McClory or MGM is folding or Sony is buying something, you know, and there's just all this behind-the-scenes stuff that, I mean, the Eon Productions, the Broccoli family, they are obviously, they have a legacy of being great producers, but their hands are tied in ways that Mission Impossible isn't, because Mission Impossible lives and dies by the strength of Tom Cruise, you know, and Paramount is not going to really push him around, at least not now. I mean, maybe they did a little, you know, they would have a little bit in the post couch jumping era, but, you know, he is the key to all of this, and he's not going to let this go in any direction that he doesn't want. And despite the strength of Barbara Broccoli and Michael Wilson, James Bond doesn't have that. James Bond, I mean, I think Spectre got a ton of studio notes, you know, and you just don't get that from Mission Impossible in a subordinate kind of way. You know, you get it. I mean, McCrory talks a lot about how they test screen these movies like crazy and take lots of notes and receive lots of notes. But it's a different process there because they're in control of fixing it. Whereas with a movie like Spectre, I believe that the script was just kept kind of getting shoved around and Sam Mendes was being told what to do. And it's just a different, it's unfortunate for that franchise, but they just don't have the measure of control that they did at their height. Or even recently with something like Casino Royale, you know, where it's just a fresh reboot and they made one of the best ones. I think there's, you know, there's reasons for that, but I think at this point you take all those reasons off the table and you just look at the feeling that I got when I was a kid watching The Living Daylights or The Spy Who Loved Me or Goldeneye. I haven't gotten from James Bond honestly since Casino Royale. But I do get it in these Mission Impossible movies. Whether it's the reliance on, you know, giving it a darker edge or the increased CGI, even when it's really done well, I feel there's a oppressive weight when it comes to these James Bond movies that it feels a little bit like homework, you know, and that's not the case with Mission Impossible at all. Like, Mission Impossible is pure candy. And I just, that used to be what I got from James Bond, but I don't get it from there anymore.
Yeah, and something that James Bond has had several times, Mission Impossible finally has, and that's a repeat director in the franchise. And so McCrory is now as big a part of Mission Impossible as Tom Cruise is. I mean, I obviously maybe not as big because he's the face and the producer and the guy who gets these things made. But I mean, it's pretty clear that their collaboration is paramount to the success, and the existence of these movies and perhaps moving forward. I mean, it was strange that McCrory came back when nobody, even the caliber of Brian De Palma or John Woo or J.J. Abrams or Brad Bird, came back after they had made a movie. But here McCoy is making another one. I mean, they just like what they did so much with Rogue Nation, they decided to forge ahead, and now they've made what is potentially, in many people's minds, the best of the series. I can only think that Tom Cruise is satisfied with the end result and will probably want McCoy to come back.
So I was actually just listening to the IndieWire Toolkit, I believe is the podcast that you recommended to me, the interview. And at the end of the interview, McCoy, he kind of hints that, like, he's kind of done. He doesn't really want to come back. But at the
Well, he said he had no plans to make Fallout either.
Yeah, exactly. Of course not. But at the French premiere, after the movie ended, Tom Cruise nudged him and said, hey, we can do better. So clearly, I think Tom Cruise is not ready to let go of McCoy. And McCoy is pretty darn good at this. I wouldn't blame him if he wants to go do something else. I mean, he's not old by any stretch of the imagination, but he is, I think after, especially after this weekend, he's probably in a pretty privileged position in terms of getting his next thing made. So, you know, I hate to even take it here, but if this was it, I think I would be pretty satisfied. Like, I don't need a billion more of these movies, partly because I'm starting to get worried for Tom Cruise's life. but of course, I'm also not going to, you know, I'm not going to turn down another McCoy Mission Impossible movie either. So I'd be excited either way. But I think that in terms of, like, the franchise hitting its stride and the franchise having a umbrella and a guiding hand, I think that it's worth at least bringing up Bad Robot. The last four movies have all been Bad Robot productions. Obviously, J.J. Abrams directed. J.J. Abrams' feature film debut was Mission Impossible 3, which, you know, that's a pretty accomplished first feature. You know, and he has been involved in all these movies since then. I mean, I don't think he's been, like, overwhelmingly in every story meeting or anything, but they're all Bad Robot movies, and Bad Robot is J.J. Abrams' company, and it's his Amblin, you know, it's his thing. So I think that his cachet has helped an awful lot, kind of protect these movies and protect Cruise and McCoy and Bird, and give them the space that they need to get the job done. But yeah, I felt like it needed to be mentioned, you know, that we have J.J. Abrams to thank for how great these last few movies have been too, because once he took over, I mean, I'm willing to group Mission Impossible 3 right in there with Rogue Nation and Ghost Protocol as, you know, the best of the one of the high points of the series, which is again a series of almost all high points. So yeah, I want to throw that out just as a J.J. Abrams mark to say, hey, thanks, man, again for another thing.
Yeah, I don't think that there's a chance that they're through after Fallout. I think we're getting...
No, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, at least one more, if not with McCoy as director, but I think he is coming back. I mean, people just go listen to his interviews about this movie, but the circumstances that have led him to direct the last two movies are hilarious, as he explains them in great detail, and they both involve Tom Cruise basically telling him, look, you're directing these movies, and like, you have no choice, and it's an offer that McCoy can't refuse, and he knows it. And the point that you make, like, McCoy, you know, he's not getting any younger, and he might have other projects he wants to do. I mean, that, in a way, was sort of his logic before agreeing to come back to Fallout, and he said Tom Cruise told him, look, that's fine. You should do whatever you want. If you don't want to direct this, that's okay with me. No hard feelings, but this is a go picture, and it's pretty rare that you get a go picture just handed to you on a silver platter, so it's up to you. And McCoy
exactly.
Was like, you got a point. Let's do it.
Yeah, and like I said, he wrote this. I mean, it wasn't – I think Drew Pierce got story credit or screenplay credit on the other one. So, I mean, there was other people involved, but this was a movie that, yeah, he was just like – a movie star was like, here's my schedule and $200 million, and you can do from a blank page whatever you want to do. And, yeah, I think that, I mean, he's probably going to get that opportunity again. But also, he will get that opportunity again elsewhere if he wants to at this point, you know? I want another one of these, but at the same time, I like Way of the Gun. I like his other screenplays that he's written and movies that he's made. I would love to see a $50 million Chris McQuarrie crime thriller that he makes in 6 months and then gets back to the Mission Impossible. You know, I want his Christopher Nolan prestige, Inception, Interstellar, you know, in between franchise original movie.
I'm with that. I'm with that, but I also want big blockbusters in the hands of people like Chris McQuarrie, you know? Like, if we can maintain that, I mean, look, even if it's, you know, one of those formats of one for you, one for me, like, if that's what it has to be, then fine, but it seems like the Mission Impossible movies fit both of those for Chris McQuarrie. It seems like he really enjoys it, and I hope he continues down that path. I mean, when we talked about Rogue Nation, right after we saw that, my reaction to that was Christopher McQuarrie should have the keys to any car he wants in Hollywood. Like, whether that's a franchise, whether that's an original idea from him, whatever, give it to him. He's great. And after Fallout, I mean, that's reinforced him then some. I mean, the guy is just one of the most talented people in Hollywood. And I wonder, like, he is such a writer's writer, but he's also obviously proven himself as a pretty amazing director of action specifically, but just director in general. I mean, he's a writer-director. Do you sense that Christopher McQuarrie from these last two movies, do you think of him as auteur?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I mean, I mentioned the nods to the other Mission Impossible movies, but I think also with the John Lark Mystery Man subplot, that's a bit of a callback to Usual Suspects. And if you look at all his movies, I mean, he's just got this crime, hard-boiled crime screenwriter feeling to him. You know, he's like a Dashiell Hammett kind of crime writer, and I think that's what he likes to do. I think he's an exceptional writer-director of that, you know? So, yeah, I mean, I think you can find kind of an authorial through line to all his work. And if you look at The Way of the Gun from a directing standpoint, there are these widescreen compositions that you would see in one of these movies. And obviously the action scenes are very precisely put together, and there's an incredible shootout in that movie. There's a shot in Jack Reacher of Tom Cruise in the muscle car kind of zooming up to the camera that is reused in Fallout. So, I mean, he's got these kind of recurring tricks, but he's also said in those interviews that we keep citing that he feels like he's been in film school until this movie, you know, and that he's been developing as a director, and he actually feels like he's getting started as a director after making this freaking huge movie at age 50. So, yeah, I think if he keeps going at this pace, I think you'll be able to look at his career, and I think he'll have a similar body of work as somebody like Christopher Nolan. I mean, obviously in a different genre and a different tone, but I think all his movies so far have been his movies.
What's interesting is you said that, you know, he felt like he was in film school up to this movie, but I also heard in one of the interviews him say that, talking about the composer, is it Joe Kramer from Rogue Nation?
Who,
obviously didn't do this one, and he had mentioned that there had been speculation as to why he wasn't on this movie, and one reason McQuarrie gave was he wanted this movie to feel like it was from a different director. And so that left Joe Kramer out as composer, and that brought on, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, is it Lauren Balfe?
Yeah, I think Balfe, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either, and apologies, but just to highlight the score for this movie, it really, like, hit me hard when I saw this for the first time, and I think that's unusual for scores to do, like, to really make themselves noticeable, and that can obviously, it can be a bad thing if you notice the score, but for me, I was just loving it. Like, I was, like, laughing at, like, how awesome it was. I felt the same way watching Incredibles 2 and hearing Michael Giacchino's score. this summer, whatever, like that score for me is the best of the year so far. It's one of the best action movie scores I can remember. It's just on the short list for one of the best of all time. But obviously this is a series that has a bunch of great scores. I mean, you've got work from Danny Elfman and Michael Giacchino, and Joe Kramer did great work in Red Nation. But for me, Lauren Balfe, like, killed it in Fallout. And ever since I've seen it from a few days ago, I've been going back and listening to that amazing soundtrack. Do you agree with me?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's perfect for this movie, and I totally see why he would want a different feel than the Joe Kramer score for Rogue Nation. That movie is a little bit more classical and a little bit more almost Hitchcockian in a way, and that score has a Bernard Herrmann old-school brassy feel, whereas this movie is a little bit more modern. It's a little bit more Michael Mann, Christopher Nolan. And so something more electronic, Hans Zimmer-ish works. So yeah, I mean, it's super intense. It fits the movie. I've kind of become a bit of a nerd when it comes to these Mission Impossible scores, and kind of I naturally gravitate towards orchestral and symphonic scores over electronic, but, when it works, and when it fits, and it fits here. I do think, I think there's an interesting, different conversation to have about Lauren Balfe and the whole Hans Zimmer remote control school of composers, where there's kind of this like sound that they all share. And I think that Oliver Harper, you mentioned a tweet on Twitter about how there's a cue in here that sounds a lot like the Dark Knight Rises Hans Zimmer score. There's a good chance that the reason that those two scores sound the same is because Lauren Balfe did work on Dark Knight Rises, perhaps. I know a lot of, I think Henry Jackman, Benjamin Wallfish, I believe, did the part of the Dunkirk and part of Blade Runner last year. So there's these kind of apprentices, Ramin Djawadi, that does the Game of Thrones score. There's all these apprentices of Hans Zimmer that come out, and they have similar sounds to him, and then they kind of develop into their own identity. So I think that there's some similarities here to Zimmer's work, but that's not bad, because it's, again, it fits the film and it fits the style. And yes, this is a pulse pounding, extremely intense score. And yeah, I also have been listening to a lot, and yes, select tracks have made it to my prestigious Spotify playlist.
No, it's not bad. Not bad at all. And I think that along with some of the modern sounds you're talking about, there is plenty of orchestral stuff going on there, just in terms of strings and brass and piano when it comes
to the White Widow theme.
Like,
there's this recurring piano thing that comes on during the foot chase through London that I love. I wasn't trying to say that this is a Tangerine Dream score. I'm just saying that there's zero electronic in like the Giacchino score or for the third one or the Joe Kramer score. And I think Joe Kramer even put himself, challenged himself to only use instruments that were available when Lalo Schifrin was doing the score for the original TV show, which I think is a cool exercise. But like I said, I get really geeky about this stuff. So
I went back and watched some opening sequence. Well, I mean, I've gone back and watched all the movies before seeing it, but the opening sequences in particular, the credit sequences, and I love how in the first movie it does that trick that basically shows you the entire movie out of order.
Yeah.
During the credits, they do that again. They've done that for the past three movies again. But I went back and watched the Ghost Protocol opening credits, and I'd kind of forgotten that Giacchino's score for that movie is so weird and kind of jazzy. You know, during the opening credits, it's like, wait a second, this has to be sort of like a throwback to like Lalo Schifrin's work in terms of like writing the original music, but maybe just his entire like career in general, but I just thought this was kind of weird for Mission Impossible. It's kind of cool to go back and listen to.
Yeah, it's got like electric guitar in it. it's definitely a quirkier one than his one for the third movie, which is a little bit more traditional and just one of those Michael Giacchino scores that's just like from the get-go is just like, you know, balls to the wall, like orchestral noise and wonderful in that way. And I mean, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the incredible Danny Elfman score for the first movie, which I was obsessed with when I was 13. But I think it's cool that here's a franchise we have where Lauren Balfe, he out-Zimmers Hans Zimmer, which Hans Zimmer's score for Mission Impossible 2 has a lot of great moments. But I think he was working pretty hard on Gladiator at the time, and you can kind of sense that.
Yeah, those opening credits are not the best out of the franchise. They're really, really
shredding.
Silly. I
mean, a lot of shredding going on.
Yeah, it's not the best, just in terms of like the actual like titles and graphics and the score itself. So yeah, I'll give it to the Mission Impossible 2 haters on that front. But I guess Ben, to sort of like close here, like film franchises, especially action franchises, they're supposed to degrade over time. They're supposed to get progressively worse and maybe like work their way towards straight to video releases and we're supposed to kind of forget about them. I mean, that's just not really the case anymore. It seems like more and more these days anyway. It's certainly true for some movies, but these big studio film franchises, they try to up the ante. And in the past, upping the ante has been bad news. You know, you sort of like try to create a little more spectacle while rinsing and repeating what worked about the first one. But you have these franchises like Mission Impossible and like Fast and Furious that we mentioned, at least up to a point anyway, where it's like, look, we're going to get bigger and better. Like, we're going to try to outdo ourselves from a quality standpoint and give you another fantastic experience and challenge ourselves creatively. I think Mission Impossible is probably the most shining example of that right now, a franchise that just the movies in a way are equally lovable, but for my money, they like Tom Cruise and everybody at Paramount and everybody that works on these movies, they're striving to make these movies as good as they can and trying to make to do even better than they did the movie before. Like, what do you think it is about the resilience of this franchise that has put them in a position to do that? And do you think it's something that it's been going for so long that I don't want to say necessarily that can maybe set a trend for the rest of Hollywood, because I think that this is pretty unique at this point. But what do you think it is about this franchise that has become so special?
I think pragmatism is part of it. Everybody seems to turn this off and go listen to the McQuarrie interviews, but I was just listening to one where he was talking about how the studio was like, hey, we need Chinese box office, so put this Chinese actor in the movie. I think it was, I can't remember if it was Rogue Nation or this one. Maybe it was this one. And he was like, well, okay, I'm cool with getting money from China, but let me talk to them. So he went and like talked to these Chinese executives, and he was like, do you want this actor in the movie? And they were like, yeah, I guess so, but really what our audiences want is a premium experience and like an experience that you can't get anywhere else, because, you know, movie theaters are opening and the bigger the movie, the more audiences are going to appeal to audiences. So big special effects, 3D IMAX. And so he said, okay, I'm going to shoot it in IMAX. And I guess that works. I mean, I think that'll do well. You know, he, instead of just saying, oh, this trend, we got to do that, he boiled it down to, okay, so people like stuff for a reason. Let's not just do the thing that people like. Let's figure out what people like and then do our version of that, you know, and organically work ourselves to that, you know, and figure out, okay, we want more market exposure or whatever. We're not going to consider that an evil thing that we don't consider in our movie at all. But when we do consider it, we're going to consider it responsibly within the context and organically within the framework that we've built and that applies to this franchise. And it's like, that's just smart. You know, that's just like basic common sense. But I think because there's so many fingers all over so many of these movies that you get this powerful person that hops in and says, make it 3D. It's like, well, oh, okay, well, we shot everything already. Well, it doesn't matter. Send it to India and post-convert it. It's like, oh, okay. And, oh, well, this art is important, or this thing is big, or this is a big deal. And there's this attention span, this shallow thinking, this short attention span, shallow thinking that goes into a lot of these movies. I think, I don't know, I don't make these movies, but that's kind of based on the fraction of insight that I have from these podcast interviews. That seems to be a pretty big difference here, is that there's a core group of people at the heart of this franchise that are A, invested in making great movies, and B, invested in responsibly doing everything they can to make a lot of money with those movies. You know, it's like, I don't think any filmmaker doesn't want to make money, but when you allow them to organically come to the conclusions that they need to come to let these franchises make money and be good at the same time, then it's going to pay off. But not every writer director thinks the way that Chris McQuarrie or Christopher Nolan or J.J. Abrams think about these things. I mean, you still have plenty of franchises that are just grasping at whatever to be popular, or are held hostage by the movie star at their core and can't escape, you know, the kind of whims of that individual. I think it just comes down to who pulls the strings and what their priorities are.
Yeah, and I think Tom Cruise is obviously a big part of this. And
sure,
you know, and what's weird though is, like I mentioned, the three movies that he was making at the same time between the Mission Impossible movies, and it makes you wonder, well, does Tom Cruise extend himself and put as much of his, you know, heart and creative aspirations and what entire being into the rest of his work as he does Mission Impossible? I mean, it obviously has a lot to do with who he's collaborating with, whatever studio maybe that he's working with. But, you know, with these Mission Impossible movies, it's clear that he cares about the audience. He wants to wow us. And I think what's great about his pairing with Chris McQuarrie is Chris McQuarrie is so obsessed with story. And when Tom Cruise wants to generate or provoke an emotional response from the audience, McQuarrie meets him in the middle with this philosophy that the best way to do that is to attach emotional meaning to the spectacle. And to make every explosion, to make every shot, to make every punch, to connect that with something emotional that will in turn provoke an emotional response from the fans who are watching it. And I think that they succeed with that in a pretty large way. And so moving forward, I personally hope McQuarrie sticks around. I'm having too much of a blast. I'm also with you. Look, I mean, if it stopped right now, fine. They've done an amazing job. But if just based on the sample size we have now, I trust these guys. Like, I trust that they're going to stay consistent. They have built an unbelievable sort of new foundation for the series, a nucleus of an amazing acting ensemble. The crew is obviously second to none. So if they keep going with this, if they feel like that's what they need to do and they can keep getting better and making great movies, fantastic. But like you said, if they stop right now, either way, totally fine with it.
Absolutely. I mean, the next one I've already read is going to be a straight-to-video. It's just going to be Ving Rhames. Tom Cruise isn't coming back.
Drinking beers.
Yeah.
Which they did. Yeah. They drank beers at the end of the first one, at the end of Ghost Protocol.
Yeah.
All right, well, fine with me, man. At least we know Ving Rhames is going to look good doing it.
Always. Those hats. God, those hats. Killer.
I will choose to accept it.
For more Film Nerds Unlimited, go to filmnerds.com or find us on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you hear, rate and review our podcast on iTunes. Keep an eye out for the next issue of Film Nerds Unlimited, coming soon.